Chapter 24. Kovach's orders had been specific to the five men he'd dispatched to watch over the dismantled responsivist facility in the Philippines. They weren't to interfere with people investigating the building unless it became apparent that they were going to breach the underground sections. In the weeks they had observed the site, the only interest shown had been a couple of Filipinos on a well-used motorcycle. They had remained only a few minutes, looking over the building to see if there was anything worth looting. When they realized everything had been stripped, they had roared off down the road in a cloud of blue exhaust. The way the two approached today had put the guards on immediate alert, and when the blast echoed across the open field, they knew their caution had been well-founded. Amid the tumult of crashing cement, Juan fell through the hole Link had created, landing solidly on his feet on a flight of steep stairs. The air was an impenetrable wall of dust, forcing Cabrillo to run blindly down the steps, trusting that Link had cleared out of the way. A piece of cement the size of his head hit his shoulder with a glancing blow, but it was enough to throw him off his feet. He tumbled the last few steps and lay dazed on the landing as more debris rained down all around him. A powerful hand groped for the back of his bush shirt and drew him into an antechamber and out of what was becoming an avalanche. "Thanks," Juan panted as Link helped him to his feet. Both men's faces and clothes were a uniform shade of pale gray from the dust. The timber scaffolding that supported the weight of the concrete plug gave way entirely, and tons of cement and broken wood crashed onto the staircase, completely filling the entrance to the antechamber with rubble. The darkness inside the chamber was absolute. Link pulled a flashlight from his haversack. The beam was as bright as a car's xenon headlamp, but all it revealed were clouds of concrete dust. "Remind you of anything?" Link asked with a dry chuckle. "Little like Zurich when we sprang that banker a while back," Juan answered with a cough. "What do you think of our reception committee? I feel like an idiot for thinking it was going to be that easy." "Amen, brother." Link flashed the beam across the choked-off doorway. Some of the concrete slabs had to weigh half a ton or more. "It's going to take a couple of hours to dig our way out of here. As soon as we open even a small hole, they're going to gun us down like fish in a barrel." Juan purposefully engaged his pistol's safety and slid it into his waistband at the small of his back. "Outgunned and most likely outnumbered. I don't fancy clawing our way into an ambush."
"Wait them out? Won't work. We've got one canteen and a couple of protein bars. They could sit out there from now until doomsday."
As he spoke, Juan was fiddling with his satellite phone.
"Then we can call in the cavalry. Eddie can have an assault force here inside of 48 hours.
I'm not getting a signal.
Cabrillo turned the phone off to conserve its battery.
"All right. You've shot down all of my suggestions. What's up your sleeve?"
Juan took the light from Link's hand and played it along the downward sloping tunnel that had been bored into the earth decades ago.
"We see where this leads.
What happens if they come in after us?"
"Hope we have enough warning so we can lay an ambush.
Why not wait for them right here?"
"If I was leading that team, I would lob in a bunch of grenades before committing my men. We'd be mincemeat before they needed to fire a single shot. If we hung back out of grenade range, we'd be too exposed in this tunnel. Better to find a more defensible position. On the bright side, if they do bother to come after us, it most likely means there's another way out of here."
Link considered their options, and with a broad sweep of his arm indicated they should proceed down the subterranean passageway. One wall of the tunnel was a long, continuous slab of stone, while the other showed signs that it had been worked by tools. The two men could walk comfortably side by side, and there was at least 10 feet of headroom.
"This is a natural fissure the Japanese expanded during their occupation," Cabrillo said as he studied the rock.
"Most likely split open by an earthquake," Link agreed. "They built their factory, or whatever the hell it was, where the hole reached the surface."
Juan pointed out dark splatters on the stone floor. The spray pattern indicated it was blood. Copious amounts of blood. Gunshot.
More than one victim, too. Juan jerked the light away from the grisly tableau. His mouth was a thin, grim line. The air temperature dropped and the humidity built as they descended deeper into the earth. It was thinking about the misery that had occurred here rather than the plummeting temperature that made Cabrillo shiver. The tunnel wasn't straight, but rather corkscrewed and twisted as it fell away at a gentle angle. After 25 minutes and more than 2 miles, the cave floor leveled out and they discovered the first side chamber. The entrance was partially blocked by a minor cave-in, and the tunnel's ceiling was a fractured mess of stone ready to collapse at any moment. This cavern, too, had been a natural geologic feature that the Japanese had expanded. The room was roughly circular, 50 feet across, with a ceiling that was at least 15 feet high. There was nothing in the cavern except some bolts along the walls that had once carried electrical wiring. Administration area, Link wondered aloud. Makes sense, being the closest room to the surface. They found 2 smaller side caves before discovering a 4th in which the Japanese had left artifacts behind. This chamber had 12 iron bunks bolted to the floor and several flimsy pressed metal cabinets along one wall. As Juan checked the drawers, Link examined the bedsteads.
You wouldn't think they would have bothered giving their prisoners beds, Link said.
There's nothing in any of these drawers. Juan looked at Lincoln. They needed the beds because they had to restrain their victims. Someone intentionally infected with typhus, cholera, or some type of poison gas is going to thrash around.
Franklin snapped his hands away from the metal bunk as though he'd been burned. They found 4 more side chambers like this one, some large enough to hold 40 beds. They also found a small, waist-high cave entrance in the main tunnel. Juan wriggled his head and shoulders into the aperture and saw that the cave beyond dropped precipitously. At the extreme end of his light's range, he could see the floor of the cavern littered with all sorts of unidentifiable junk. This had been a communal dump, and amid the rubbish were human bones. They had become disjointed over the decades, so Cabrillo couldn't tell how many there were. 500 would be a conservative estimate.
This place is like a slaughterhouse, he said when he pulled himself free. A death factory. And they kept it running for 18 months. I think the surface facility was used solely to maintain the secret laboratories down here, where they experimented with the really nasty stuff. Using a cave system meant they could isolate it in a hurry if they ever had a viral outbreak. Ruthless and efficient. There was no admiration in Link's voice. They agreed on a spot to lay their ambush in one of the smaller medical wards. Link bundled up some blankets and mattresses in the shape of 2 men huddled under the farthest bedstead. Juan rigged a booby trap using a roll of electrical tape from Link's bag, the chemicals, and his canteen. In the uncertain glow of a flashlight, the mannequins were more than sufficient to lure the responsivists. He placed Link's cell phone on walkie-talkie mode between the 2 inert figures. Link and Juan backed off into a room opposite and a little farther down the tunnel to wait. If Juan had any difficulty with what they were about to do, he only had to think about the victims aboard the Golden Dawn to harden his resolve. The minutes trickled by, the luminous second hand of Cabrillo's watch moving as if the battery was nearly spent. But he and Link had lain in countless ambushes, and they remained perfectly still, their eyes open, although they could see nothing in the Stygian tunnel. Each leaned against the stone wall with his head cocked, his ears straining to pick up the slightest sound. After only 20 minutes, they heard them. Juan picked out 2, then 3 distinct footfalls as the responsivist gunman rushed headlong down the tunnel. There were no lights, so he reasoned they carried an infrared lamp and night vision goggles capable of seeing in that spectrum. The gunman slowed well before they came to the side cave, as if expecting an ambush. Although Juan couldn't see the guards, he could tell by the sounds what they were doing. They had gone almost silent as they approached the entrance, advancing only when they knew they were covered by their teammates.
Metal clattered against stone, and almost immediately a voice called out. "I see you there. Give yourselves up and you won't be harmed." The sound had been one of the guards leaning his weapon against the cave entrance to steady his aim as he pointed his assault rifle at the bundles of mattresses at the far end of the chamber. Standing behind Link so the big man's bulk shielded his voice, Juan triggered his cell phone and said, "Go to hell." With the volume of the phone left inside the medical ward set to maximum, it must have sounded like a defiant shout. Two guns opened fire at once, and in the burst of the muzzle flashes, Juan could see all three figures. These men were no rank amateurs. Two were right outside the cave while the third held back, watching the tunnel for a flanking attack. In such an enclosed space, the sound was an assault on all Cabrillo's senses. When the firing stopped, he waited to see what they would do. They had poured enough rounds into the chamber to kill a pair of men a dozen times over. The cover man snapped on a flashlight as all three stripped off their goggles, their optics temporarily overwhelmed by the barrage. The two who had fired moved cautiously across the threshold, while the third remained vigilant for a trap. And Cabrillo didn't let them down. The tripwire he'd rigged was near the bedstead where he and Link had supposedly made their last stand, and the lead guard was so intent on his victims, he never saw it. The electrical tape was tied to the bottles of chlorine and sodium bicarbonate, and when the gunman brushed against it, they fell. The glass shattered in a pool of water from the canteen and one other chemical that Juan had poured on the floor. At the sound of the bottle breaking, Juan and Link fired. The third guard had reacted to the sound of the smashing glass, but he didn't stand a chance. One bullet caught him under the arm and tore apart his internal organs, while the second hit him squarely in the windpipe. His corpse spun to the ground, never relinquishing its grip on the flashlight or assault rifle. The beam came to rest on the cave entrance, where tendrils of a sickly greenish cloud were just beginning to emerge. Inside the chamber, the chemical reaction had produced a small lake of hydrochloric and hypochlorous acids. In the seconds it took for the two men to realize something was wrong, their throats and lungs were burning. The fumes attacked the delicate tissues lining their airways, making even the shallowest breath a torture beyond pain. Forced to cough from the irritant, they drew more of the toxin into their bodies, so that by the time they staggered out of the room, they had gone into convulsions. They hacked blood mixed with sputum from deep inside their lungs. The exposure had been brief, but without immediate medical attention, the two gunmen were living corpses, and their deaths would be slow and agonizing. One of them must have realized it, and before Cabrillo could stop him, he had pulled the pin on a hand grenade. There was a split second to make a decision, but with the roof already so unstable, there was only one thing to do. Cabrillo grabbed Link's arm and took off running, not wasting a moment even to turn on his flashlight. He ran with his fingers brushing the tunnel wall. He could feel Link's towering presence behind him. They had both been counting the seconds and, at the same moment, threw themselves flat just as the grenade exploded. Shrapnel peppered the tunnel all around them, and the overpressure wave hit in a wall of light and sound that felt like a sledgehammer blow. They scrambled to their feet as a new sound grew, seeming to fill the tunnel. The roar became deafening as slabs of rock dislodged by the blast crashed to the tunnel floor in a cascading avalanche that threatened to engulf them. Dust and bits of rock fell on their heads and shoulders as more of the ceiling gave way. Juan flicked on the flashlight just as a chunk of stone the size of a truck engine slammed into the ground in front of him. He leapt over it like a hurdler and kept running. Overhead, cracks appeared in the roof, jagged lines that branched and forked like black lightning, while behind them the din of collapsing rock rose to a crescendo. And then it began to subside. The roar petered out until only a few stones plinked and clattered. Juan finally slowed, his chest sucking in drafts of dust-laden air. He aimed the light toward the tunnel behind them. It was choked, floor to ceiling, with rubble. "You okay?" he gasped. Link touched the back of his leg where a shard of stone had hit him. There was no blood when he looked at his fingers.
Yeah. You? I'll be better when we get out of all this dust. Come on.
Look on the bright side, Link said as they started walking again. We don't have to worry about them coming up behind us anymore.
I always had you pegged for a Pollyanna.
They spent another 2 hours exploring the underground facility. They found bunks for 180 prisoners, rooms that had once been laboratories, and a piece of equipment Link recognized as an atmospheric chamber.
Probably to test the effects of explosive decompression, he'd remarked. At last, they came to the end of the long tunnel. It didn't peter out or pinch off. Rather, a section of the roof had collapsed, and both men recognized that it had been blasted free.
Juan inhaled next to the mound of rubble, noting that a faint trace of explosive lingered.
This was brought down recently.
When the responsivists pulled out?
Juan nodded, not giving in to his disappointment just yet. He scrambled up the sloping pile of loose rocks, his feet dislodging debris as he neared the top. He pressed himself flat and ran the light along the seam where the shattered stone met the ceiling. He called down for Link to join him.
There was nothing in this catacomb that the responsivists would care that we see. It's all just old junk left by the Japanese army.
So whatever they're hiding is beyond this.
Stands to reason, Juan said. And since they risked coming down here after us, I bet that our exit is on the other side too.
So what are we waiting for?
With the water used up to improvise the gas attack, an hour of back-breaking work left Juan's tongue a sticky, swollen mass, as if some scaly reptile had curled up and gone to sleep in his mouth. His fingers were raw and bleeding from shifting the jagged stones, and his muscles ached from the cramped position. At his side, Link worked with the efficiency of an indefatigable machine. It looked as if nothing fazed him, but Juan knew even Lincoln's vast reserves of strength weren't inexhaustible. Bit by bit, they burrowed their way into the rubble, moving carefully, testing the ceiling to ensure their actions didn't bring down more of the shattered stone. They changed positions every 30 minutes. First, Juan attacked the debris and passed stones back to Link's waiting hands, and then Link would take point, loosening boulders and handing them back to the chairman. Because Link was so broad in the shoulders and chest, the passageway had to be expanded to almost twice Juan's size. Juan was back at the rock face and reached for a handhold on a particularly large stone, but no matter how he tried, he couldn't loosen it from the rest. It seemed to have been locked into place. He shifted some smaller fist-sized stones, hoping to get leverage, and pulled with everything he had. The rock didn't so much as wiggle. Above the lump of stone, the ceiling was rife with cracks and fissures, as unstable as the area the responsivists brought down with their grenade. Miners called such a ceiling a bunch of hanging grapes, and Juan knew that a chunk could dislodge without warning. He'd never felt the chilling effects of claustrophobia before, but he could feel the icy fingers of panic trying to worm their way into his mind.
"What's the problem?" Link panted behind him.
Juan had to work his tongue around his mouth to loosen his jaw enough to speak.
There's a stone here. I can't move.
Let me at it.
They laboriously swapped places, with Link moving feet first into the tight space. He braced his boots against the rock and his back against Cabrillo's outstretched legs and brought his strength to bear. In the gym, he was able to leg press 1,000 pounds. The boulder weighed half that, but it was wedged tightly, and Link was in the beginning stages of dehydration. Cabrillo could feel the intense strain in every fiber and tendon of Link's body as he pushed. Link let out a growl, and the rock slid up and out of its socket of loose stones and packed dirt like a rotten tooth.
"Now that's what I'm talking about," he whooped.
"Nicely done, big man."
Link was able to wriggle forward, and as Juan followed him, he realized he was gaining headroom. They had crossed the highest point of the debris pile and were making their way down the backside. Soon, he and Link could crawl over the remaining stones on their hands and knees, and then they could stand upright. So they walked down the last of the rubble and onto the cave floor. When Juan pointed the light back at the pile, the gap near the top seemed impossibly small. He and Link rested for a few minutes with the flashlight off to conserve its batteries.
"Smell that?" Juan asked.
"If you're talking about a mug of ice-cold beer, you and I are having the same hallucination."
"No, I smell seawater."
Juan got to his feet and turned on the light again. They proceeded down the tunnel for another 100 yards until it opened into a natural sea cave. The grotto was at least 50 feet high and 4 times as broad. The Japanese had constructed a concrete pier on one side of the subterranean lagoon. There was a set of narrow-gauge iron train tracks embedded in the cement for a mobile crane that had once been on the dock for unloading supplies.
"They brought ships in here," Link said incredulously.
"I don't think so," Juan replied. "I noticed when the ferry docked that the tide had just crested. That was 7 hours ago, which puts us near low tide." He played the light along the side of the quay where a thick carpet of mussels clinging to the cement indicated that high tide almost swamped the dock.
"I think they supplied the base using submarines."
He killed the light, and together they peered into the dark waters for any indication of sunlight penetrating this far into the cavern. There was a spot opposite the pier that glowed so faintly that it looked as if the waters weren't exactly blue, only less black.
"What do you think?" Juan asked when he turned on the light. "Sun's at its zenith. For it to be so dark in here, the tunnel has to be a quarter mile long or more." He didn't add that it was too far to swim on a single breath. Both men knew it. "All right, let's look around and see if there's anything left down here we can use." There was only a single side chamber off the main cavern. Inside, they discovered a trickle of fresh water that seeped from a tiny crevasse high up the wall. The water had eroded a small bowl in the floor before meandering to the ocean. "It's not cold beer," Link said, cupping his hands in the bowl, "but nothing's ever looked so refreshing." Juan, aiming the flashlight around the room, indicated that Link should drink his fill. Propped against one wall was a row of strange stone tablets. All thoughts of thirst vanished as Juan studied the artifacts. They were roughly 4 feet tall and 2 wide, made of baked clay that was less than an inch thick. It wasn't the stones themselves that held him rapt. It was the writing. An awl or stick had been used to etch the clay before it had been fired, and despite the tablet's obvious antiquity, there was absolutely no sign of weathering. It was as if they had spent their entire existence in a temperature-controlled museum. Then he spotted the wires. Thin lines arced from the back of one tablet to the next. Juan shone the light in the gap between the tablets and the cave wall. Blocks of plastic explosives had been stuck to the backs of all 4 ancient texts and rigged to one another. He followed the wire and realized it went out toward the main tunnel. He figured it had been set to blow when they took down the ceiling, but the wire must have been cut before the signal reached this chamber. Judging by the amount of plastique, the responsivists wanted to leave nothing of the tablets but dust. "What have you got?" Link asked. He had washed the grime from his face, and water had cut runnels through the dust on his neck.
"Cuneiform tablets rigged with enough semtex to send them into orbit."
Link studied the explosives and shrugged. They knew well enough not to touch it. If it had decided not to go off when it was supposed to, they weren't going to give it any reason to do so now.
"It's cuneiflower."
"Cuneiform. Perhaps the oldest written language on Earth. It was used by the Sumerians, dating back 5,000 years.
"What the heck are they doing down here?" Link asked.
"I haven't the foggiest idea," Cabrillo replied, reaching for his camera phone so he could take pictures of the tablets. "I know later cuneiform script had a more abstract look to it, like a bunch of triangles and spikes. This looks more like pictographs."
"Meaning?" meaning these date to the very earliest uses of the language.
He checked the images captured by his camera and reshot a few of them so they were clearer.
These could very well go back 5,500 years or more, and they're in pristine condition. Most examples of cuneiform have to be pieced together from fragments as small as stamps.
Listen, man, this is all well and good, but it isn't exactly helping our situation. Get some water, and I'll finish looking around.
Cabrillo had drunk from $1,000 bottles of wine, but nothing could compare to that first sip of water from the spring. He drank palmful after palmful and could almost feel fluid coursing through his body, recharging his muscles and clearing the fog of exhaustion that had been clouding his mind. His stomach was sloshing by the time Link finished his reconnoiter.
"Looks like we stumbled into the responsivist's love shack," Link said. He held up a box of condoms with only two remaining, a wool blanket and a trash bag with a half dozen empty wine bottles.
"I was hoping you'd find a scuba tank and a couple of dive masks."
"No such luck. I think we're just going to have to swim for it and hope like hell one of us makes it."
"Let's head back into the main chamber.
I don't do my best thinking around explosive charges."
Cabrillo considered inflating the trash bag with air and towing it behind them so they could each take a breath halfway down the tunnel, but its buoyancy would make it scrape along the roof of the submerged tunnel. The plastic would tear before they'd gone 2 feet. If they counterweighted it so it maintained neutral buoyancy, the drag would make their progress impossibly slow. There had to be a better way. Link handed him a protein bar, and for the next few minutes the men chewed silently, racking their brains to come up with a solution. Juan had shut off the light again. The faint glow coming from the far end of the cavern beckoned with both freedom and frustration. They were tantalizingly close, but the last obstacle seemed insurmountable. And then an idea hit him out of the blue that was so outlandishly simple, he couldn't believe he hadn't thought of it first. "Any chance you recall the German words for sodium chlorate? It's a toxic salt used as a pesticide."
"Natrium chlor. I remember seeing a jar or two of it back in the dispensary."
"And you still have that second detonator pencil?"
"Yes."
"We're going to make an oxygen candle. While I'm gone, I want you to scrape up iron filings from the railroad track. When you mix the two and ignite them, the reaction produces iron oxide, sodium chloride, and pure oxygen. I'll swim halfway down the tunnel and find somewhere to fire it off. The oxygen will displace the seawater, and we'll have a bubble where we can breathe."
"More voodoo chemistry from your high school teacher?"
"Actually, I got this from Max. We have oxygen generators aboard the Oregon for when we rig the ship for fire or chemical exposure. He explained how the system works."
Juan was going to need the flashlight, so he left Link at the railroad track to scrape the shavings they would need with his knife.
It took Cabrillo 40 minutes to navigate his way back through the partially collapsed section of the tunnel, reach the dispensary, and return to the sea cave. In that time, Link had managed to produce more than enough iron filings from the old rail. Working under the beam of the now dying light, Cabrillo mixed the chemicals in one of the empty wine bottles and wound the rest of the electrician's tape around the glass while Link took apart the detonator to reduce its explosive charge. When they were finished, Juan inserted the detonator into the top of the bottle and wrapped the makeshift oxygen generator in the plastic bag.
"Rube Goldberg would be proud," Link joked. Juan kicked off his boots and pants at the edge of the quay and tossed his bush shirt aside.
"Back in 5, he said, and lowered himself in the bath-warm water. The sea around him clouded with the dust that washed off his skin. Using an easy side stroke, holding the bag and flashlight, he swam across the grotto to where he and Link thought there was an exit. Juan left the bag floating on the surface as he dove down, pressing hard with his legs and arms, the waterproof light turning the water turquoise. The salty water made his eyes sting, but it was a pain he had grown accustomed to over the years, so he set it aside.
At first, all he saw was jagged stone covered in kelp and mussels, but when he reached a depth of 15 feet, a yawning tunnel opened up in front of him. It was easily 50 feet around, more than enough to accommodate a World War II-era submarine. When he turned off the torch, he could see the faint glow of sunlight at the very extreme periphery of his vision. He returned to the surface and corralled the bag. He began taking deep breaths, filling his lungs to the maximum, purging as much carbon dioxide out of his system as he possibly could. When he began to feel lightheaded, he thrust himself out of the water to clear his chest so he could take an even deeper breath, filled his lungs, and dropped back into the gloom. He followed his flashlight beam downward and entered the tunnel. The tidal action that had created the cavern system kept the sides free of marine life. He counted the seconds in his head as he swam. He hit the 1 minute mark and noted the sunlight was markedly brighter. He kept going, keeping his mind clear and his body relaxed as he went deeper into the tunnel. At 1:30, he turned the flashlight to the ceiling. 10 feet farther, there was a concave space in the rock, a natural dimple, easily 5 feet across and 1 foot deep. The bag had just enough air in it to keep it pressed to the ceiling. Juan felt through the plastic for the timing pencil and activated the detonator. He turned and started swimming away, keeping the same measured pace he'd used to enter the tunnel. He'd been under 3 minutes when he cleared the tunnel's mouth and angled for the surface. He broached like a dolphin, coming halfway out of the water, expelling the air from his lungs in an explosive whoosh. "You okay?" Link called out from the darkness. "I might have to give up my occasional cigar, but yeah, I'm fine." "I'm coming over." An instant after Link said it, Juan heard him dive into the water. He was at Cabrillo's side moments later, with their boots laced across his shoulders and their clothes tied around his waist. "I double-wrapped your cell with the condoms," Link said. "It's in your pant pocket."
"Thanks. I forgot all about it."
"That's why you're giving me a raise when we get back aboard ship." Link's bantering tone then vanished. "Just so we're clear, if your little Frankenstein experiment doesn't work and there's no pocket of oxygen, we just keep going?" The distance was too great for even the best swimmer, so when Juan replied, he knew it was their death sentence.
"That's the plan."
The detonator was too distant and small to feel through the water, so Juan let 10 minutes tick by on his watch before asking Link if he was ready. They began to hyperventilate, each knowing their bodies enough to keep from becoming euphoric from too much oxygen. Together they dove for the tunnel. For some reason, it looked ominous to Cabrillo. Like a massive mouth, and with the slight ebb tide sucking at him, it seemed the rock wanted to swallow him whole. The flashlight was fading fast, so he shut it off as he and Link swam for the distant glow coming from beyond the cave. After 1.5 minutes, he turned the light back on and began searching for the oxygen pocket. The tunnel's ceiling was featureless rock. The underside of the bubble should flash silver like a pool of suspended mercury, but the light revealed nothing but blank stone. Juan had slowed as he searched and had just a second to decide if they should accelerate in a desperate but hopeless dash for the exit or keep searching for the dimple. He panned the light around and realized they had drifted to the right. He cut left, followed by Link, and still couldn't see the bubble. The taste of defeat was as bitter as the salt water pressing his lips. His oxygen generator hadn't worked, and he and Link were going to die. He started stroking hard toward the distant tunnel exit when he felt Link's hand on his ankle. Link was pointing a bit more to their left, and when Juan hit the spot with the light, he saw a flash like a mirror. They swam to it, expelling the air in their lungs before surfacing carefully so as not to hit their heads. Neither cared that the oxygen was still warm from the exothermic chemical reaction and had a foul smell. Juan was inexorably pleased with himself and was grinning like an idiot.
"Nice piece of work, Chairman."
There was only enough oxygen for a 3-minute break. The men filled their lungs greedily before they committed themselves to the final leg of their journey.
Last one to the entrance buys the beer when we get back, Juan said, taking one last breath before dropping into the tunnel. A second later, he could feel the water churning as Link swam in his wake. A minute into the dive, it looked as though the outlet had grown no closer. Even with the tide working in their favor, their progress was much too slow. When he was in his 20s, Juan could free dive for almost 4 minutes, but there had been a lot of hard living in the years since. 3:15 was the best he could manage now, and he knew Link's big body burned oxygen even faster. They continued onward anyway, stroking through the crystal water as efficiently as they could. At 2:30, the mouth of the cave had finally brightened but remained impossibly out of reach. Juan felt the first flutter at the base of his throat telling him he needed to breathe. 15 seconds later, his lungs spasmed without warning and a little air escaped his lips. There were 20 yards to go, 60 tantalizing feet. By force of will, he clamped his throat to fight his body's urge to inhale. His thoughts started to drift as his brain burned up the last of his air. He was growing desperate, his motions uncoordinated. It was as if he no longer remembered how to swim or even how to control his limbs. He'd been close to drowning before, and he recognized the symptoms, but there was nothing he could do about it. The broad ocean beckoned. He just couldn't reach it. Juan stopped swimming and felt water sear his lungs. And as soon as he did, he started accelerating. Link had recognized the trouble Cabrillo was in and had grabbed the back of his t-shirt. The ex-SEAL had to be as desperate to breathe as the chairman, but his legs kicked like pistons, and each great arc of his right arm propelled them closer and closer. Juan had never seen a more determined display. Link was simply ignoring the fact he was drowning and kept swimming anyway. The water suddenly grew lighter as they emerged from the cavern. On guts alone, Link dragged them to the surface. Gasping, Juan spewed a mouthful of water and coughed up what felt like lungfuls more. They clung to rocks like victims of a shipwreck as the sea surged gently around them. Neither man could speak for several minutes, and when they could, there was nothing to say. It would take an hour of hard climbing and another 2.5 to circle far around the former Japanese installation before they reached their hidden jeep. Cabrillo had put the ordeal behind them even before they reached the top of the cliff. His mind was focused solely on the images stored on his cell phone. He didn't know how or why, but he was certain it was the evidence he needed to blow the case wide open.